We're on landline.
Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to take
Hello, everyone. Hey, we are back for another episode of Paranormal Horizons. I'm Jason Ophir, and here with Sherry Pang. We're experiencing some weird technical audio bleed over. I don't know what that's about, but hopefully that'll stop. Sherry, how are you?
Oh, hanging in there. How are you coping with the heat?
I'm coping quite well. I'm in an air-conditioned basement. I'm actually cold, and I know I think that the whole country is hot, and you're saying that it was 104 in Beaverton. How are you dealing with it?
I've been indoors, so I was fine. I took my dog out for a very short walk, and I just couldn't wait to get back in. But my girlfriend texted me, and she said it was 104 degrees in Beaverton. Can you believe that?
That is crazy. I went out once at 8 o'clock this morning, and I've been nice and cold since in the basement watching movies. But other than that, yeah, it's really hot. I guess it's really hot. I read some story, I think it was somewhere in Iran, where it was like the air felt like 150 degrees, you know, when they say that.
Oh,
it's,
my
you know,
goodness.
Where it's like that saying where it says, like, well, it's 115, but it feels like 150. Well, I guess some place in Iran set some new record where it felt like 150 degrees. Craziness.
How can you deal? That's so dangerous. Well, I heard the desert was like 120-something. I have a friend that was out in Blythe, California, and he said it was in the 120s in around Blythe.
Oh, that's crazy.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Anything been going on? You noticed anything going on in the paranormal?
Nothing really spectacular. I mean, there's so many things to talk about. I think we'll save it when we go on open lines, but nothing to speak of. Nothing in the paranormal except one of our guests, and I think he's going to be showing it on his own Facebook page. But James Cloud, who I think was last week, he was talking about attachments, and right now he's dealing with some demonic entities in a house, and I'm not going to disclose the location, but I let's put some prayers up for him, and whoever's listening, you know, just say some prayers for their safety and for the paranormal team.
Absolutely. Demons aren't fun. So you lined us up a great guest this evening. We got Neil McNeil, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. He's he's in paranormal. He's in the scientific realm. He'll go into a little bit more detail when he introduces himself. He's right out of Northern Washington, Seattle area, and I'm really happy to have him for the first time. So is he on cue?
Yeah, we'll bring him on in.
Oh, let's bring
Hello.
Him on.
Hey,
Hello
Neil,
there.
How's
Can
it going?
You hear me?
Yep, sounds great.
Going really well. Going really
Hi,
well.
Neil.
How are you two doing tonight? Hi, Sherry.
How's the weather up
Good.
North?
Well, it's not too bad. It's not as bad as Beaverton, what you just said a few moments ago, but we got up into the mid-90s today, so not too far behind.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, if it's
not
over 80
bad,
degrees.
Not too bad, though, all
hot.
Things considered. I have some friends in Phoenix this week, and I don't envy them.
Oh, my
Yikes.
Goodness. That's all awful. Yeah, I remember living in Arizona, and, you know, I do have to say one good thing. Even though it is hotter, it's a dry heat. It's not like up here where there's a lot of humidity and moisture. That can make a difference.
That's true. I've been on the East Coast. I've been in D.C. in the middle of summer, and that's about as humid and hot as I want to experience. So I'll take the Pacific Northwest type of humidity any day of the week.
Yeah, that's crazy. Wow. Okay, so Neil, why don't you just quickly introduce yourself, and we'll just get on in and have you come on the floor.
Well, sure. I've actually been in the field of paranormal investigation and, more importantly, parapsychology, which is the science that studies paranormal phenomena. I've been hanging around this field for about 25 years or so. Got my start after meeting Professor Lloyd Auerbach. Some of your listeners might know who that is. He's pretty much the main Ghostbuster. Wrote the book on paranormal investigation back in the 1980s. And I haven't really looked back since that meeting back in the early 90s. I've gone into sort of self-scholarship in the field of what's known as psi phenomena or psychic phenomena. So one of the things that I do is I teach. I'm in education at this point. So I teach classes, I teach courses in the fundamentals of parapsychology. So basically what I'm helping people understand is phenomena like ESP, like telepathy or precognition or remote viewing, and things like psychokinesis, otherwise known as mind-matter interaction or mind over matter. And I also do field research in haunted houses and apparition cases, as well as poltergeists. So that's kind of my forte. That's the area that I work in and the area that I teach.
Now, Neil, let me ask you, do you also teach about or have experience or knowledge in remote viewing? That's just a general question.
Yes, actually I do, because remote viewing, or what's known commonly as clairvoyance, is one of the main fields of study with parapsychology. In fact, a lot of research has been done with that over the last several decades. And yes, I have actually taken part in experiments with remote viewing. I just did one a couple weeks ago. I was actually one of the receivers because I do have some small psychic ability myself. So I was actually taking part in a remote viewing experiment there. So yes, that's actually one of the areas of study that I'm familiar with.
Do you believe that everybody, and I'm interested in remote viewing, but, you know, it's interesting. Do you think that we all have that ability, just like we all came with some sort of, and some level of psychic ability? It's just a matter of degrees and how you develop it?
I think that's pretty much true. I agree with that. I think that everybody has some kind of psychic ability to start with. It's there, whether you like it or not. It's what you do with it. So in other words, everybody can exercise. Everybody can go join a gym, but not everybody's going to turn into Arnold Schwarzenegger. So there are people that just seem to naturally be predisposed to having these abilities, one or more of these abilities. And depending on what they decide to do with it throughout their life, they can either strengthen that, just like you would if you were going to the gym, or let it kind of go fallow. Some people have done that as well, and then come back to it later in life. So it really does seem to be almost like a muscle that you can work and build, but you've got to stay at it. This is really true with remote viewing, which is actually something that can be taught, has been taught. Some of your listeners might be familiar with the work that the government did when they contracted parapsychologists to begin scientific research into remote viewing and the possibilities of using that for, basically, for lack of a better term, psychic spies back in the Cold War. And what they discovered at Stanford Research Institute was that it didn't take any special talent, per se, to learn remote viewing. They could literally pull people off the street and teach them a course in how to remote view correctly. And people would have varying degrees of success, but just about everybody seemed to be able to do it to one degree or another. So, yeah, I really do think that we all have the ability. It's just what we decide to do with it and how we go about it that makes the difference.
Well, when I hear Ed Dames, and he's one of the masters of remote viewing, the guy is just phenomenal, not only with his abilities, but also being able to teach it. So it's wonderful that you're able to do that yourself, and it's good to hear that.
It's something that I kind of took for granted because I've been able to do these sorts of things since I was a child. I thought everybody did these things. I thought it was just a natural, everyday kind of event for most people. When I was a kid, it was basically precognitive dreaming. And then that developed into a little bit more of clairsentience and clairvoyance, as we've been talking about with the remote viewing. So for me, the abilities have actually changed a little bit throughout my life, depending on what my life circumstances were and how close attention I was actually paying to them and developing them. So, yeah, once again, I really do believe that everybody has these abilities, whether they know it or not.
Is there any proof that... any proof that backs up any of these abilities? Like, has it been studied under scientific conditions? I know way back in the day, maybe it was the 60s or 70s, there was a Russian lady named, I could be pronouncing this wrong, Nina Kulagina or something, who could light matches that were surrounded by a box and move stuff. Is there any scientific evidence that is close to irrefutable that kind of validates any of these psychic abilities?
Well, the careful answer, as a scientist, I have to say, it depends on who you ask. There are people that are going to say, yes, there is irrefutable proof, or at least evidence. And then there are people who are going to say that none of it actually has been proven. From my point of view, yes, there actually is quite a lot of evidence. It's anecdotal evidence in some cases, but we do have research institutes around the world that have been studying these phenomena for well over 130 years. The search for the scientific basis for these phenomena actually started back in the mid-1800s with psychical research. And what they were doing back then at the turn of the century was going into the field and looking into reports of apparitions and thought transference, and being able to move objects with the mind, and they would go into the medium salons and that sort of thing. That's not really the evidence that we're looking for at this point, because so much of that could be faked, so much of that could be fraudulent, and it did turn out to be. But basically, the era of studying these phenomena in a controlled setting, in a laboratory setting, started in the 1930s. At Duke University, what became known as the Ryan Research Laboratory, or the Ryan Research Center, which is still in operation today. Joseph Banks Ryan, basically his interest was to put ESP, or extrasensory perception phenomena, under a microscope. And in doing so, conducting tests under controlled circumstances. This is, of course, where we have the famous ESP or Zener cards, the cards that have all the symbols on them. Those kinds of tests were what he developed back in the 1930s to the 1950s. And, of course, it's just progressed since then with places like the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory that ran for many, many years, the Kessler Institute overseas. There's a number of research labs around the world that have looked at these phenomena and have been able to say definitively, this kind of phenomena we call telepathy, or mind-to-mind communication. This kind we call precognition, or the ability to foretell events. This kind we call psychokinesis, or the ability to affect physical environment with the power of your mind. We don't understand how these things work yet. That's going to take a few more years, but basically there is a mountain of evidence that has built up over the decades that points to the fact, at least statistically speaking, that these phenomena really do exist, that they defy conventional explanation, and that they are observable. Part of the problem with this is twofold. Number one, the repeatability issue. Can one laboratory in one country repeat, an experiment that's been done here in the U.S. and therefore give us a greater standing stability with regard to our evidence? Repeatability is an issue, and I think part of that is from the next problem that we have in studying these phenomena, is that it's been realized that out in the field, when these things are happening to everyday people in everyday life, the effects are actually fairly large and noticeable. When we bring them into the laboratory, when we try to study them under controlled conditions, they get much smaller. It's almost like the phenomena itself gets shy and becomes much smaller and harder to observe. And that's why we have to rely on statistical analysis when we're talking about the research that happens in the lab. So there's the very long-winded answer. The short answer is that it's going to depend on who you ask, but for my money, absolutely. We do have the evidence that does say that something is going on. We can't quite explain what it is or how it's functioning, but it is very real, and we have this evidence that actually does back that up.
One of the things that I always kind of think about is, because I'm a little bit of a skeptic, and there's James Randi, who I know you're probably familiar with, who's been debunking the psychic phenomenon for probably 40 years, and he has this challenge of $1 million to anybody that could prove to him under his conditions that there's psychic powers. So I've watched him on his shows debunking all this stuff, so it always kind of makes me a little bit skeptical about it. What do you think about the work he does? Do you think that he's just testing people that are charlatans or don't really have abilities, and that there are people out there that do?
From a professional point of view, I have to remind myself that anytime James Randi is involved in an investigation or an experiment, that he himself is a magician, a stage magician, which on the one hand is a great thing, because stage magicians and mentalists know what to look for when they're trying to determine whether or not somebody's abilities are genuine. That's a good thing. Unfortunately, he does not have any other credential in the paranormal field. He is not a parapsychologist. He does not read the research. He is not on peer-reviewed panels or anything like that. It's basically when the million-dollar challenge. There's $1 million put into a bank account somewhere, and I think the conditions of this have changed recently. But generally speaking, he's had this $1 million challenge for so many years. Unfortunately, if you attempt to claim the $1 million and you have to perform, you perform for him personally, not a panel of experts, not parapsychologists or people from any of the classical sciences, no physicists, no biologists, nobody from the medical field. It's all to his standard and his satisfaction. And unfortunately, his standards keep changing over time. And unfortunately as well, and this is on record, you can just start Googling this if you like, but Randi himself has been caught being a fraud on his own terms. In other words, there have been a couple of parapsychological groups that have put forward their experiment for review for the $1 million challenge, to which he has accepted, and then at the last moment, he has backed out of his own challenge without really giving any concrete reason why. And supposition being what it is, you can make that work any way you want. But I find it just very interesting that here we have all of this research that does point to something statistically significant, and we have someone who really doesn't have any understanding of parapsychology whatsoever making these claims. And unfortunately, because he is a media figure and has managed to basically make his career off the paranormal, people listen to him. It's the same principle that happens when I have students that in a class, all their base information comes basically from television and what they see in reality television programs. And the fact of the matter is that that's a complete misperception. That is not what real paranormal investigation is. It certainly isn't what parapsychologists do. The fact of the matter is that the science itself is actually rather boring, but it doesn't make very good copy. It doesn't make good television, and Randi is basically the same way. The funny thing is that Randi and his kind, and there are several of them out there, basically call parapsychologists and psychics and mediums, it's a pseudoscience to them. And at this point, we've caught them being guilty of the same things that they claim we're doing, so we call them, you know, pseudo-skeptics, because they're not true skeptics. True skeptic is actually middle of the road and will take evidence and weigh it and try to figure out whether this is valid or not. And unfortunately, that isn't what happens most of the time.
Yeah, I commend...
Go ahead, Jason.
I commend the work he does. I mean, there's so much nonsense out there in the world with scammers and the paranormal and Photoshop and video editing. It's so hard to know what actually to believe anymore. You know, but you know, you mentioned remote viewing, and you know, the government did spend a lot of money into it, so maybe there is something to it. I mean, have you had, since you've done some remote viewing, have you had some pretty remarkable results doing that, that are kind of, you know, where things were validated to where you were accurate?
Under controlled conditions, no. One of the things that I do teach a college class in kind of the fundamentals of parapsychology, and part of that class is that we do some experiments, informal experiments, in the classroom. And many times the students, remote viewing is one of the easiest things that we can actually look at as far as an experiment in a group setting. And so we do that. And many times I have actually had entire classrooms full of people. We're talking about 15 to 20 people all getting significant hits on the target image, which has been randomly selected, has been sealed in an envelope, has been mixed in with other sealed envelopes, and that randomly selected. You know, I try to do as many controls as I can. And yes, I have actually had the experience where a classroom of people will, as a group, all of the details that each particular person comes up with, individually, you might not think that it's that much of a significant piece of information, but 15 or 20 people, when you combine all of their observations and all of the things that they say that they're seeing, it paints the full picture of the target image. So to me, that is an informal experiment. That's still rather significant because these people have never done this before. They have no formal training in it whatsoever. And they're just trusting me that there's actually going to be a photograph in that envelope. And yet they're able to come up with basically very good detailed descriptions of what that target image is. It does depend on the situation, on the group, size of the group, time of year, you know, emotional states, all those kinds of things do come into play. And those are variables that we can only account for to a certain degree. But yeah, I actually have with remote viewing itself had rather remarkable results with that.
Uh-huh.
It sounds
Wow.
almost like there's a collective element to it when you're saying that, you know, as a group, all the pieces kind of come together. That's interesting.
It does seem to be that way, at least with some of the phenomena. Most certainly psychokinetic or mind-matter interaction phenomena, probably the one that most people are familiar with. And I'm just using this as an example because it's a popular concept. We don't actually use this as a test. But the old spoon-bending thing, where you go back in the 80s, if you were part of a major corporation, one of the team-building exercises that they had would be that you and, you know, 50 or 60 of your fellow employees would go to a hotel ballroom for this group thing, team building exercise, and you'd all try, you know, you'd be there screaming at the cutlery, trying to get the knife or the fork or the spoon to bend and twist and do that sort of thing. And it does seem to be that with some of these phenomena, specifically with psychokinesis, that the more the merrier, the more people that are there, the more people that believe that they can do it, the better the result. And so, again, it kind of goes back to that idea that out in the field, in the real world, the effects can be pretty spectacular or remarkable or at least notable. In the laboratory, when they're under observation, not so much. They're smaller, they're harder to see, they're harder to record. So there is this duality to the phenomena that we're beginning to understand.
I know that, you know, probably the most famous spoon bender is Uri Geller. And I know after,
yeah.
I remember hearing about a televised thing where he was bending keys and a bunch of people were reporting that keys in their pockets had bent and stuff like that. But I also remember seeing Tonight Show, where he was to do the spoon bending under the conditions of maybe even James Randi that was involved with that, under certain conditions, and he wasn't able to bend the spoons on the air. I mean, it's all very fascinating.
It is, and again, I'm only using the spoon bending because it's a popular image that most people can latch onto. And yeah, Uri Geller, while I do believe that he has some actually rather significant talent, has had some controversy as well. A lot of the big name psychics and psychic mediums who are basically, you know, this is their career and they're in the limelight, there is a lot of controversy that surrounds them. And so you're never sure exactly what is real talent and what isn't until you bring them into a controlled setting. However, having said that, as I tell my students, psychics and mediums, being a psychic or being a medium, that is the only profession that I know of that I can kind of point to right off the top of my head where you have to be correct 100% of the time. If you miss it, if you're not on, if you don't perform 100% of the time, then there's doubt, and then people begin to say that you're a fraud or that you really don't have any significant talent or ability. Surgeons, neurosurgeons, anybody in government, nobody has a track record like that. Baseball players, football players, nobody is 100% all the time. And yet, for whatever reason, we expect mediums and psychics to be on all the time. Now, I can't do that in my job, and I'm assuming you can't do that in yours, so it makes me wonder what it is that, you know, why we're trying to hold them to this absolute ideal. Just food for thought.
I like the way you put that, because that makes a lot of sense to me. Nobody's perfect at everything or whatever it is, you know, 100% of the time. So that actually makes sense to me a lot.
Yeah, and it's so true. It's as a psychic medium, and I can only share what my experience is. And as I used to be a makeup artist and used to do modeling and commercials and on TV, and I'll tell you, this is how I feel, is that you have so many takes. I mean, if I did a politician commercial, or we did a commercial for Henry Whitehorse beer or Calvin Klein jeans, we've had so many takes, and we would shoot for just a 2.5 minute spot. We would shoot for 12 days, and you know, it's like the reality is that nobody's 100%. Yes, you have good days. Yes, you're accurate more so than other days, but we're all human, and I think that needs to be taken into factor. We see psychic or mediums that are on TV. And I know this for a fact. They take the best. They edit. They're probably filming a whole week, and they edit to just maybe an hour. They take the best of what they have, and they shoot that for, what, not even an hour, because you've got commercials. So actually, it's 45 minutes or 40 minutes, you know? So that's the reality of it.
It is, and that's actually the perception that most people have just about paranormal investigation in general from watching these television programs. And as you say, because, you know, I used to be a radio DJ myself and in production, and I know how all of this goes. You've got an hour-long program, which is really, I think, 42 minutes once you take out all the commercial time.
Exactly.
And you've got to have that story. A story editor is going to take all of, you know, that week's worth of filming and needs to cut it down and make it interesting and make it exciting so that it sells advertising. And I hate to be cynical, but, you know, this is actually how broadcasting works. So it doesn't do to have a cable television network put on a paranormal investigation program where people are sitting around interviewing people, sitting around for hours waiting for something to happen, monitoring equipment and gauges and whatnot. That's the reality of it. It's actually very boring work. It's laborious. And then you take all of that work and you've got to review all of it. And you know, all of these kinds of things. Research goes into this. But you never really see that portrayed accurately there on television, because it's not exciting and it isn't going to get viewers and that sort of thing.
It's true, glamorized, and they don't understand too. Neil, even Jason, as a paranormal investigator, you look at the different variables. There's so many things. It could be stress, it could be temperature, it could be, you know, how the day is, it could be what you ate. I mean, there's so many different variables on how an outcome can take. And like you said, people just have that, you know, glamorized thing that you're just you're a hero.
Well, it becomes, it becomes this idealized image of what the paranormal should be. You know, every
exactly.
time I have a paranormal encounter, it should be scary, it should be frightening, it should be really noticeable, there should be something dramatic to it. And in point of fact, if you actually go through the parapsychological literature of documented cases and reports and whatnot, usually it's a nice encounter. Usually it's a compassionate or comforting encounter, or something that would be barely noticeable, or maybe something that you dream or have a flash of insight, those kinds of things, rather than the stuff that you see portrayed on television. And that's not to say that there aren't some, you know, programs or whatever out there that are at least doing a decent job of presenting it. Not everybody is that way. But it feeds this public perception of what the paranormal should be. And unfortunately, that just isn't the reality of it. So I've actually had clients, you know, with cases of paranormal activity who didn't know that they were actually experiencing the paranormal because it wasn't like what they were used to seeing on television. You know, I had a kid, just as a case in point, there was a gentleman that I was working with several years ago whose apartment seemed to be haunted. He actually seemed to have an apparition, and he was very, very frightened. And I asked him, what is the most frightening thing that has happened to you? And he said, well, I was making out the checks for all of my bills, and I couldn't find the stamps to put on the envelopes. And I knew I always keep a roll in the desk drawer on the left-hand side. It's always there. Couldn't find it. Tore the office apart. Couldn't find it. He went into the other room. He came back, and there was a roll of stamps on his desk, and all of the letters had been stamped. And I said, that's the most frightening thing that's happened to you in this whole case? And he said, well, yes, that really, really freaked me out. And so part of my job is to try to normalize these experiences. And I said, well, you know what? That almost sounds like having a secretary. I would love it if somebody would pay my bills. And so he was able to see it from a slightly different point of view rather than this fear-based, you know, basically genre that we have going on right now. So it's a tricky area. It's kind of a bit of a landmine here and there. But that's what we're here for. That's what we're trying to do, is to educate people.
Yeah,
that's
if there's any
great.
Ghosts out there that any ghosts out there that want to clean my car, that would be great. Appreciate it.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
A thousand chores that I could definitely use a paranormal butler for. That would be great.
A paranormal butler, that's great. I love that.
So what about the paranormal and haunting? Now, I've done some paranormal investigating, and I've, of mm-hmm. course, captured things that I can't explain. You know, I always look for, you know, reasonable causes of things. But in your experience, have you run into things that are, like, what are some of your more experiences that you've had that are really kind of mind-blowing?
Mind-blowing. Well, yeah, there's been a few. Probably one of my favorite cases involved a family of four north of Seattle. We were investigating. I was actually working with a team of people at that point. And my job at that point was running environmental sensors, so EMF meters and temperature sensors and light variability and all those kinds of things, just trying to get a baseline of what was actually happening in the environment. I walked into a room in the downstairs. Everybody else was upstairs interviewing the family. I was on my own downstairs, and I walked into a room, little girl's room, and I got maybe 3 feet in the door, and I fetched up against something. It was like I ran up against a wall. I mean, literally, bam, smack into something, and there was nothing in front of me, not a single thing. And yet, all the hair on my arm stood up, and I had the impression, don't ask me why or how, but I did have the impression that there was somebody standing in front of me, that it was a male, that he was somewhat taller and better built than me, and that he was very, I had surprised him, he was very surprised and upset and angry that I had entered his space. This was apparently his space. Now, this is all happening, I'm getting all this information in a flash, in an instant, as I'm running into this invisible wall. I did the best I could. I kind of basically tipped my hat and said, excuse me, it's my fault. I should have knocked first, and I backed out of the room and collected myself, made my notes, went back and joined the group upstairs, and it turns out I had no prior knowledge of the events that had happened in this location. I was coming into the situation blind. That was one of our controls. It turns out that that room, the little girl's room, was where all of the activity had been happening, and that the family had encountered a man matching that description, that he was very angry, and he had torn the room apart on a couple of occasions. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. I have no explanation for what it was, if there was actually something physical that I ran into. Sure felt like it, even though there was nothing to see. And that I'm getting all this information about this purported character who is actually spending all of his time in this room. So that was you know, a fairly interesting case. That very same case, one of the other investigators was late to the investigation, came in, started setting up his camera equipment, and pulled us aside and said there was a lady in a big floral print dress sitting on the couch. Where is she? Because I need to get an interview with her. And everybody was looking around at each other. There was nobody there matching that description. However, there was an apparition that matched that description that had been seen in the house by related family members. So again, you know, take it for what it's worth. Here we've got two people encountering things. They had no prior knowledge of the activity in the house, and yet here we are experiencing the very same things that people had been experiencing and reporting in that house for months prior to that.
It's interesting. I actually experienced something similar. I was in a historic hotel here in Portland that's connected to the Shanghai tunnels. So I rented the most haunted room that was reported to be the most haunted room. And when I very first got in there, I went to the room and I walked in. It wasn't a physical thing, but it felt very unpleasant. The air was thick, and I was thinking to myself, there's no way I'm going to be able to spend the night in this room. So I hurried out of there, dropped my stuff, went down and ate, and came back, and the room felt totally normal. Like whatever was there had left. So I don't, you know, it was really weird. And I've encountered that a couple times.
And there's, you know, and skeptics will take a look at that and they'll say, well, that's actually parapsychology. This is what we call the subjective paranormal experience. This is an experience that you've had of something you consider paranormal that is not objective at all. It is completely subjective because it was only your experience. But that doesn't invalidate it. It doesn't mean that it isn't a valid experience or piece of the puzzle. One of the things that we try to do in field investigation, it's very important to pay attention to the history of the phenomena. So if you experienced that in that hotel room, and for the last 20 years, people have been experiencing that very same thing in that room, hopefully with no prior knowledge of what had been going on in there. It doesn't sound like you had that information, Andy. You have to begin to wonder, what is it about that room that is causing people to have the very same experience time and time again? That's actually what we're looking for. So when people say that we don't really have evidence for the paranormal, that really isn't true. We do have evidence, but it's accumulated. It's oftentimes experiential. It's anecdotal. But the more layers that you're able to put down on these phenomena, it happened, you know, when it isn't enough for me on an investigation to just say, well, we had the infamous cold spot that we were able to measure. That's a nice ghost story, but that's all it is. It's one piece of evidence. We need more than that. We need that. We need cooperation from people who have experienced that cold spot previously, temperature gauges that verify that, maybe a psychic that's there that's able to verify that. All these independent pieces of information that we overlay, and that's the kind of evidence that we're actually looking for. So, you know, to my way of thinking, if you tell me that story as an experience, I would say, yeah, that sounds like it could be a paranormal experience. And who am I to say? Because it was your experience, and I don't want to take that away from you.
Can I ask you something like that? When you have experienced like that incident, Jason, is that something, do you think that is current, that is that person or whatever paranormal experience or something still there? Or is there a possibility, is it maybe residual energy that is left and it hasn't been dealt with. So people, whoever, the, you know, people that go through there are experiencing the same thing. That's a question I don't know.
Yeah, that is actually an excellent question. I'm sorry, were you asking me or were you?
Yeah,
I'm asking both
asking?
Of you. I don't know. That's just something that came through my mind, and just asking both of you a question of what you think.
Let me just add real quick. Initially, I would have thought I'm a pretty logical person, having been an investigator, like not a paranormal investigator, but just investigator by occupation. I would have thought maybe the psychology is just going into a knowingly supposed haunted room, that maybe I was psyching myself out. But what I thought was odd about it was why I didn't feel that after lunch and I came back. Like, why did that suddenly completely leave? If it was a psychological thing and it was and I was just something I was creating in my mind because I knew it was haunted, then why wouldn't I have felt that throughout the evening or at all?
Which is an excellent, excellent observation, which to me lends a little bit more credence to the experience, because you were kind of expecting something like that to happen. The psychology aspect of it, of the expectation, you know, people are going into a known haunted location or a location that has had a long history of hauntings. Obviously, the expectation is there. You're basically front-loading, whatever data you're already skewing it, you're already biasing whatever data you're going to be collecting later on in the day or the evening as the investigation goes on, because you have that expectation. In parapsychology or in real paranormal investigation, which is what I try to do, we are actually, you know, if we bring in a psychic or a medium, and I do use them, we do it in a very controlled manner. They don't have any previous knowledge. They don't know where they're being taken to. They could be taken to a house or a location that has absolutely no history of paranormal activity whatsoever. I've done that as a control. And if the psychic is coming up with all kinds of, there's blood on the walls and there's evil in the corner and that sort of thing, then I know probably they're not the real deal, you know, and I might, their track record may not be up to snuff, at least for my purposes. But the question about, you know, in those situations, what is it? Is it some residual energy that's hanging around? Is it sentient? Well, that's actually one of the areas of study in parapsychology, which is the survival of bodily death. And what we find is that if it seems to interact with people, if it seems to have a form or a shape, if it appears to people, if it tries to communicate with them or tries to interact with them, we consider that to be, here's the technical term, an apparition. We don't use the word ghost. That has too much negative connotation and baggage associated with it. We use the term apparition, which they do seem to have free will. It does seem to be whatever it is that survives or can survive the death of the body, whether that's consciousness or your personality or whatever. And for whatever reason, it's hanging around because, you know, it likes it there or it feels that it needs to be there for whatever reason. There are a number of reasons. If the activity encountered doesn't seem to have that aspect to it, in other words, it doesn't seem to have free will, it's just repeating itself over and over again. So if for instance, the same footsteps are being reported at the same time of night every year, you know, on the anniversary, that kind of phenomena, if it's repetitive, if you can't interact with it, that's what we call a haunting. And that does seem to be some kind of an event that was either emotional enough or powerful enough that somehow or another it imprinted itself on the environment, on the land, on the building, even on an object. And it just, it's like watching a movie over and over again. It just goes through the motions, replaying whatever that event actually was. So that's what we consider haunting. So we have to make a call based on what the activity actually is. We have to interview people. We really got to ask a lot of questions, and we have to be very observant before we can say, well, we think that this might actually be an apparition versus, you know, having a haunting. So, and there are examples of those all over the place, probably with hauntings at least. I think maybe the one that most people can agree about are the hauntings that happen around battlefields. Gettysburg is famous for that. A number of visitors to that park over the years have seen pickets charge or heard cannon or seen campfires in the distance, all those kinds of things. And again, those are just like on a tape loop over and over again. You could stand in front of pickets charge and they would go right through you. They would make no move to try to avoid you. That's what we call a haunting. And then, of course, if it does actually interact with you, then we know that we're working with an apparition.
I don't think I've ever in my investigations, you know, come across a really interacted with a apparition. I didn't do a ton of investigations. I probably did maybe 20 or 30. And I did capture some things, some strange EVPs, like things saying my name and stuff like that. But I got out of it. I figured, and this, I guess, kind of goes into a question. Do you think that there's, well, one of the reasons I got out of it is I, you know, we talked to a lot of people on Paranormal Horizons about the risks of the paranormal. And I kind of thought, you know, maybe I don't want to open myself up just in case there's a risk by going and investigating. Do you think there are any kind of risks, like psychically, emotionally, spiritually, the people that go out, see these TV shows and buy some equipment and go out and investigate? Do you think there are any inherent risks with that outside of like getting hurt and lawsuits?
Yeah, outside of physical damage because the ghost, you know, scares you and you take a header through the third story window. I think that's probably the greatest danger that, you know, that people have. I consider myself to be psychic, I don't truly believe in what people refer to as attachments or, you know, demonic possession and things like that. I think in most cases, in most well-observed cases, those turn out to be misperceptions. And we could actually spend a whole other hour-long show just on that topic itself. But to get to the point of your question, I think really the only inherent danger outside of physical danger is probably the emotional stress that can be suffered, either by the people that are experiencing it, i.e. your clients, the people that are asking you to come in and do the investigation, or the investigators themselves, because they sort of allow themselves to get into that headspace of you know, everything is fear-based and we're approaching this from a scary point of view because we're always doing it in the dark at midnight with flashlights, you know, that sort of thing. The reality of it is that, again, if you look at documented cases through parapsychological channels, you're just as likely to have a paranormal encounter in the daytime as you are at night. There's no special time for these things to happen. Again, it's that fear-based, you know, the spook story. We all love a really good ghost story. Who doesn't, right? And that basically is what gets a lot of people into this. So I think really the only thing that you can point to that's going to be a danger is that psychological impact. I think for many psychics and for many mediums, because they tend to be so sensitive to their environment and their surroundings, that if you want to use the term subtle energy, you know, you can go ahead and do that. They have this very, very sensitive nature. They're a little bit more at risk, if you will. And so whatever it is that they need to do in order to feel like they are safe, protected, I say go for it. I don't, as a scientist, I can't come down on the side of religion or belief, because that doesn't have really any place in actual science. That isn't to say that people shouldn't have their beliefs and shouldn't have their religious beliefs and use them if that helps them. I'm all for, you know, if you want to bring out the holy water and the crucifix, or if you want to light the smudge stick, or you want to draw a circle with salt, if you believe that that is what's going to protect you, why not? There is that psychological boost that you get. Just like we were talking about, you can psych yourself up for going into a haunted location. Well, you can have the opposite positive effect by psyching yourself up, by saying, I feel protected, I feel safe, really this is not going to be a problem. So again, you know, with the reports that people say about demonic possession and attachments and things like that, most of the cases that I personally have investigated, those have, without fail, all been misperception. All of them, without fail. And again, I'm not trying to impugn anybody's beliefs. You determine what this is based on your own filters. From my point of view, I have to look at it as a scientist, and so I just don't see the evidence for those things. It's funny that when people say or use the term demon or demonic, I often ask them, well, what kind of demon are you talking about? Are you talking about Judeo-Christian demon? Are you talking from Islamic demon? Are you talking about Buddhist demon? You know? Every culture, every belief system has their own take. And in point of fact, the word demon, which was originally spelled D-A-E-M-O-N, demon, meant a beneficial or guiding spirit until it was sort of warped and twisted over the years to become this evil aspect. And there again, we come into subjective terminology because good and evil are completely subjective. What you consider to be evil, I might think is good. What I might think is good, you might consider to be evil. It's,
wow,
it's really a matter of
game.
Degree.
Yes.
So we have a...
Wow, that's a good... That's really a refreshing perspective, Neil.
We have somebody that's been on hold for a long time. And do you want to take a question? I don't know. They could just be listening, but we'll let them on here.
Hello,
you're live on Paranormal Horizons.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. A very interesting show. I've had quite a bizarre life. I'm looking for people to actually investigate all my life experiences, but I wanted to ask your guest as a researcher if he looks at synchronicities as how they tie into the paranormal. And I'd like to give a website, but first I want to give an illustration of a very powerful synchronicity that I experienced, and it relates to a book I read back in the early 80s titled The KGB, The Eyes of Russia, written by a Harry Rositsky, who was a high-level CIA operative. I actually spoke with him after reading the book. It was before the internet, and he had retired from the CIA and had a gentleman's horse farm in Northern Virginia and was studying spirituality, theology, and it's funny how they do that when they retire from the CIA. Anyway, I lost track of him over the years. In 2008, something triggered me to see if he was still alive. I Googled his name and came across his obituary, and four synchronicities jumped right out at me. His name was Harry. My father's name was Harry. His wife's name was Barbara Helen. My mother-in-law's name was Helen. His daughter's name was Anne Elizabeth Hunt. My wife's name was Anne Elizabeth. My mother's maiden name was Hunt. Now, four synchronicities and one little obituary is pretty bizarre, but high-level CIA on top of that, that's off the charts. And I'd like to give this website for all of you to see, because I don't use email, but there's a lot on here, including some bizarre photographs, too. It's www.rooting, that's R-O-O-T-I-N-G, out, O-U-T, corruption, C-O-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. Then you have to put a dot, the word Weebly, spelled W-E-E-B like boy, L-Y .com. I actually share common background with President Trump, but I'm not into the ego. You'll see information related to that. And I'm also a former whistleblower who, back in the early 80s, that book was helpful to me. You'll see the Wall Street Journal article with attachments, and I exposed a former federal government bureaucrat. There was an investigation and eventually caused the resignation of Jim Wright from Speaker of the House in shame, the third highest office in the country. I've had UFO, paranormal, and near-death experiences with ongoing paranormal. So, I thank you for taking my call, and I hope that somebody can begin. I document as much as I can, but a lot of this is spiritually related, and that's what I want people to open up and understand. Even 100 years is like the blink of an eye in terms of eternity. We are here for a purpose, and I believe it's to learn the lesson of unconditional love. As we learn it, we're supposed to be a blessing to others, especially those who can't help themselves.
Well, I want to thank you for calling in. We only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to put you on mute. And then, Neil, can you talk about synchronicity? Or do you know anything about it?
Yeah, that could be a whole other topic. Basically, I think the gentleman has latched onto something, at least from the parapsychology point of view, and that is what we're finding out about consciousness. You know, we basically know what the brain does. We can map it. We know quite a bit about the brain. We still don't know what the mind is. We still don't know whether or not the mind is a function of the brain, or the brain is a function of the mind, or some kind of strange combination of both. And you talk about temporal studies, things that involve time, paranormal experience that involves time, precognition, retrocognition, retrocausation. There, at least in physics and quantum physics and in parapsychology, there's no reason to believe that the arrow of time is concrete, that we are only following one straight path down the timeline. It does seem to be that time itself is rather malleable, and who's to say that these things that we experience that some people term synchronicity isn't just another reflection or expression of this time and consciousness that does seem to be our basic reality.
It does seem like there are a lot of weird coincidences in the world, and I've always held the belief, and I don't specifically know how to describe the belief that I believe, which is weird, but I get the sense that there's a lot more going on in the world, almost like the world's an illusion, you know, like the movie The Matrix. Just there's something about life that just, there's something going on there other than we're just, you know, animals on a planet and evolution and all that.
A gentleman by the name of Dr. Donald Hoffman, who is head of perceptual sciences at UC Irvine, an acquaintance and a colleague, he's written a wonderful book called, I believe it's Visual Intelligence, I think is the name of his work. You can look him up. He's got several books to his credit. And this is what he deals with, is how we perceive our reality, and that the things that we experience or that we call paranormal experience have a lot in common with the things that perceptual scientists actually study and have discovered. So, you know, all of these things, to my way of thinking, all of these aspects, all of these things, they're not just individual packets. These are all part of one continuum. All of these things are necessary in order to explain the whole. So we do need the psychic and the medium experiences, and we do need the ghosts, and we do need the hauntings, and we need the quantum physics, and we need the consciousness research. All of these things have to come together, because we need all of those things in order to answer the question of what reality is and what our part in that is.
So quickly, Neil, how do you think we can evolve ourselves as far as our consciousness, our spirituality, everything? What do you suggest for our listeners to, you know, just evolve and raise our vibration?
I would really urge everyone to turn off the television, get away from the computer, and read. Read. Please read. Actually, you know, if you go to my website, paranormalstudies.org, I actually have some links in there to bibliography of books to get you started on the paranormal, where these books are written by scientists or people who have done thorough research. This is where people need to start, because, you know, the stuff on television, sometimes it's true, most of the times it's just entertainment. If you really want the real information, you've got to do the research yourself. You've actually got to get out there and do it. So, you know, there's a number of books out there. There's a number of courses you can take. Of course, back in 2012, I put out a DVD called Dark and Stormy Nights, Parapsychology for Ghost Hunters. That can be found on the website, and basically it's a synopsis of the college-level class that I do. Talks about all these phenomena, gives everybody a really good starting point, kind of levels the playing field so that we all need the same language, we need the same terminology. Most people want that, they just don't know where to go to get it. So that's kind of what my job is to be the guidepost for most folks. So my suggestion is read.
So we're just about out of time. We're going to have to wrap this up. So is there a way that anybody can contact you if they want to learn more, or is there a website or Facebook page?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, you can go to paranormalstudies.org. That's my main website. You can find me on Facebook under Paranormal Studies, or by my name, Neil McNeil. you can do that as well. I've got an event coming up in September, one-of-a-kind event here in the Pacific Northwest, happening in late September in Port Townsend, Washington. This is what we're calling the Parasci College, and this is a workshop weekend. It's a full immersion weekend. Our guest speakers are Lloyd Auerbach, Dr. Julia Mossbridge from Northwest University, Jay Verberg, who will be doing historical presentations for us. It's a full immersion weekend. If you really want to know about parapsychology and how that works with paranormal phenomena, this is the weekend. So you can actually find information about that at Parasci College on Facebook, or you can actually find the registration information on my friend's website and co-creator of this event, Ankasha Amente. You can go to ankasha.com. Find it there.
Well, Neil, I want to thank you so much for coming on. We'll have to get you back on so we can cover some of these other subjects in depth. And thanks again for taking the time to educate us a little bit on science and parapsychology.
My pleasure. I appreciate the invitation.
Thank you, Neil. Very good. We're very impressed. Thank you for the information. I'm sure our listeners can learn a lot about that. So, okay.
Absolutely.
Jason. Next week, where are we at? The first of the month? Is that what we're looking at? Yes, we are, aren't we? The second. It'll be the second.
Yes. So, yeah.
Next week, we'll have open lines. We'll get a chance to just talk about things that are random. Jason and I can get together and, just talk about different things in the paranormal and the metaphysical. And I'll take one question for psychic, not mediumship, but psychic. So if you have any questions about your love life or job or future, just call in and just have one question. I'd be happy to help you. Mediumship is harder because it can take a while if I'm plugging in and that kind of thing. So, but yeah, we'll just go open lines next week and we'll go from there.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. I want to thank everybody for taking part in this discussion. Thank the caller. Thank our guest, Neil. And we'll be back next Sunday, 8 p.m. West Coast time. And want to thank all of our listeners on 106.5 KITC FM and 107.1 KNCP in Central Oregon. That's a long-winded sentence right there. Anyways, hope everybody has a fantastic week. And we'll see you next week for another episode of Paranormal Horizons. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for listening to us. Take care. Peace.